KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. A U.S. envoy takes a rare step talking directly with a group the United States designated as terrorists. How is the U.S. trying to win the return of an American hostage? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Today we learn more about the strength of employment. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Also, how on, then pause for cars, now pause for more things tariffs could drive companies to hire less or even cut jobs.
Also, thousands of refugees are in limbo after the Trump administration froze the federal program that resettles them, and the star of a new movie about a women's wrestling pioneer. It's Friday, March 7th. On this day in 1876, Alexander Graham Bell patented the telephone, which he'd use 3 days later to make the first phone call to the next room. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump has again expressed doubt about helping defend European NATO allies. He says he may not defend them if they don't spend enough on their militaries. European Union leaders met in an emergency session yesterday in Brussels. They unanimously agreed to dramatically scale up their defense spending. However, Terry Schultz reports Hungary refused to approve a joint statement supporting Ukraine.
Recognizing Russia's war against Ukraine as what they call an existential challenge for the EU, the 27 leaders agreed to move forward on ways to come up with as much as 800 billion more euros, 860 billion US dollars, to spend on their militaries. In a separate declaration on Ukraine, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban maintained his tradition of opposing war support. Speaking after the meeting, Orban expressed skepticism about the entire plan.
We just got information about huge sum of money which is impossible to generate from the given circumstance of the European economy. We are not able to fund that.
More details on how exactly the EU executive plans to do that will be presented at another summit later this month. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
President Trump says he is starting the process to shut down the Education Department, an agency funded by Congress. NPR has obtained a copy of Trump's draft executive action directing the agency to be closed. NPR's Corey Turner says some Education Department employees have already been terminated.
Hundreds of staff have been laid off or put on paid leave. The administration has also canceled hundreds of millions of dollars in education research grants. It's kind of ironic. This draft order complains that students have made little progress in reading or math over the years. And yet Trump's Department of Government Efficiency just cut programs focused specifically on improving reading and math instruction.
NPR's Corey Turner reporting. The Trump administration is reopening a massive immigration detention center in South Texas. It's one of the largest detention centers in the U.S., with room for up to 2,400 parents and children. NPR's Jasmine Garst has more.
Private prison contractor Core Civic Incorporated has reached an agreement with the U.S. government to reactivate the detention center. According to the company, annual revenue is expected to be $180 million. The practice of detaining parents and children was ended by the Biden administration. A court order bars the government from separating migrant families. Border Czar Tom Homan has indicated they will start detaining and deporting them together instead. Advocates have denounced the move as inhumane. The announcement comes just days after President Trump reiterated his promise to conduct the largest mass deportation campaign in American history. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR. The Labor Department has released its latest monthly report on jobs. It says employers created 151,000 new jobs last month. That's not much different than January's report, when wintry weather depressed outdoor work. The unemployment rate stayed about the same at 4.1%. Economists say the massive layoffs around the federal government are not reflected in this data. That's expected to be seen in coming reports. A new study of fast-moving stars suggests they were accelerated by a monster black hole that's been lurking unseen in a neighboring galaxy. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce explains.
If two stars are orbiting each other and the pair ventures too close to a supermassive black hole, one star can get hurled away at ridiculously fast speeds, millions of miles per hour. Astronomers recently studied 21 of these speedy stars. While some were accelerated by the black hole at the center of our own Milky Way, as expected, others originated in a neighboring galaxy called the Large Magellanic Cloud. Researchers reported these results to the Astrophysical Journal, and they can now use X-ray and radio telescopes to search inside this galaxy for the telltale signs of an invisible black hole. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Daylight saving time begins this weekend for most of the U.S. Clocks will spring forward by 1 hour early Sunday morning. The time change also means one less hour of sleep. Fire officials also recommend replace the batteries in your smoke detectors along with the time change. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics with I'm Still Here, a film by Walter Salles starring Fernanda Torres. A woman is forced to reinvent herself after her family suffers an injustice by the Brazilian government. Now playing only in theaters.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, what does the United States hope to gain by talking directly with a group that it designates a terrorist organization? First, President Trump says his own threats forced a ceasefire in the war in Gaza.
But that was 6 weeks ago, and that phase of the ceasefire deal ended with no agreement between Israel and Hamas on what comes next. Now, this week, the president issued what he called the last warning to Hamas after meeting with former Israeli hostages.
NPR International correspondent Adeya Batraoui joins us now from Dubai to explain. Hi there.
Hey, Steve.
I'm just trying to think this through. There was a ceasefire that lasted 6 weeks. Hamas released some hostages in exchange for Israel freeing some Palestinians. But why haven't they agreed to the second phase yet?
Well, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he never actually sent negotiators to hammer out the details of a second phase. And he wants a different deal now that does not permanently end the war, but frees more hostages taken in the Hamas attack on Israel in 2023. So instead of proceeding with the original deal, Trump's Mideast envoy Steve Witkoff came up with a different plan in recent days that gives Netanyahu what he wants. And to pressure Hamas into this new deal, Israel's blocked all food, fuel, and aid into Gaza for 6 days now. Now, countries around the world, aid organizations, and several Israeli rights groups say this violates international humanitarian law.
So how, again, is this plan, this proposal from the Israelis and from the United States different from what was expected?
So the main difference is the original deal agreed to would have ended the war now, basically an agreement to lasting truce. And then all remaining Israeli hostages still alive would be freed over the next 6 weeks, and Israeli troops would withdraw from Gaza, and more Palestinian prisoners would be freed. In contrast, the Witkoff plan would have Hamas release half the remaining hostages still held in Gaza now, with only the promise to negotiate a lasting end to the war after 6 weeks. Hamas has not agreed to that, and Netanyahu may decide not to end the war because of pressure from his far-right coalition. He's in a bind because he has vowed to return all the hostages and eliminate Hamas, but a return to war doesn't guarantee guarantee either.
Okay, so we're maybe at this moment not getting closer to a permanent end to the war, but people still talk about what that's supposed to look like. What are some of the visions on the table?
Okay, so you may have heard Trump's idea that everyone in Gaza is going to be displaced to other countries like Egypt and Jordan, and then the U.S. takes over the Gaza Strip somehow, turning it into a world-class real estate development without Palestinians who live there now. Now, Israel's government has embraced this plan and is drafting up ways to implement it, but Egypt has been clear it will not be a part of Trump's plan to permanently expel Palestinians off the land. And Egypt says the plan is destabilizing to the region and would unravel its decades-old peace treaty with Israel. So instead, Egypt drew up a detailed reconstruction plan for Gaza of its own, and it got the backing of all Arab states at a summit in Cairo this week. They also all rejected any displacement of Palestinians. So Israel and the U.S. immediately criticized this lengthy Egyptian plan. But then Steve Witkoff said this yesterday.
I just finished reading it. There's a lot of compelling features to it. We need more discussion about it. But it's a good faith first step from the Egyptians.
So, Steve, the plan doesn't address every single concern that Israel or, you know, Gulf Arab states like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have about, you know, what would come next. And they'll be needed to help fund the reconstruction. But it would exclude Hamas from any governance. And Hamas says they agree to that.
Oh, interesting. Aya, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
That's NPR correspondent Aya Batraoui in Dubai. It's very rare that an American president would say this.
We are having discussions with Hamas. We are helping Israel in those discussions because we're talking about Israeli hostages.
The news there is the first part, quote, we are having discussions with Hamas. The United States very, very rarely negotiates directly with groups it considers terrorist organizations, and Hamas certainly qualifies. The administration says it is speaking with Hamas directly to secure the release of an American Israeli hostage still believed to be alive, Idan Alexander. The administration also wants to secure the bodies of four American Israelis. Brian Katulis is following all of this. He's a senior fellow with the Middle East Institute. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Steve.
Why does the United States normally say it will not negotiate with terrorists?
It does not want to encourage terrorist groups to get seats at the table by killing, kidnapping, doing all sorts of things that are against the rules of war. So typically, and as you said, it's rare for the United States to admit that it's talking to terrorists, but we've done it. It's not unprecedented. We've done it in different instances and mostly to try to get Americans who are unjustly detained home.
I'm intrigued by the way you phrased that, because you didn't say it's rare for the United States to talk to terrorists. You said it's rare for the United States to admit it talks to terrorists. Do you think this happens more often than we would find out about?
Oh, for sure. And certainly there are certain policy restrictions we place on our own diplomats just so that we don't want to encourage these sorts of actions by terrorists. But we talk to terror groups all the time in efforts to try to secure cessations of hostilities, other things. It's often not diplomats that do this. It's people sometimes in the intelligence community. Sometimes there are people one step removed. Yes.
I mean, that's essentially how people have been talking with Hamas in this instance. We pretend not to talk with them, but then conversations happen through intermediaries. That's been the whole way the ceasefire has been worked out, for example, over the past more than a year.
Absolutely. And Qatar, as well as Egypt, are the two countries that we lean on heavily, not only in this instance, but also if you remember in Afghanistan with the Taliban, we gained the release of some Americans there. All of the negotiations were done by, with, and through these other countries. And it's just a part of how you do business these days, because terrorist groups have made themselves a bigger factor in geopolitics. And if you want to look at means besides war to try to get things done, that's what you got to do.
Okay, so what are the pros and cons of choosing to engage with Hamas on this specific issue, trying to win the release of a hostage?
Well, the one big pro is that, and Trump has stated this, is that he's prioritized just getting hostages home. He's done this in Venezuela recently. In his first few weeks in office, he got Mark Fogel home from Russia, which is a different instance. But the one big pro is that you may be able to break the logjam, which is present because of Israel's certain stance on negotiations and moving forward with this ceasefire. I think this the con is that it actually sort of, when they announced this, I think caught Israel off guard. and embarrass them potentially. Israel does not want to see just Americans coming home. They've got a lot of pressure from their own people, obviously families of hostages who are still alive. And that could produce a gap between the U.S. and Israel and other partners. I think the other big con on all of this is obviously could incentivize terrorist groups like Hamas to do more of this.
Take more hostages and see what you can get for them, I suppose.
Yep.
I want to ask if you understand the broader situation. We just heard from Aya Batraoui that the next phase of the ceasefire was expected to come. It's held up. Israel wants to renegotiate the terms. They seem to have a different goal. The United States is also trying to help with that, taking Israel's side in that. What is going on here? What is Israel going for?
Well, that's unclear because Israel itself has not been clear about its long-term endgame in Gaza, and it's because of those divisions in Netanyahu's government. Some of the right-wing extremist voices want to take over Gaza. They're pretty pleased with Trump, with what Trump has been saying. There are others who essentially say, look, we need to separate. We need some sort of pathway to a two-state solution. That's what the consensus is in the Middle East, if you saw from Egypt earlier this week and all of the Arab nations. That's what they want. So what's going on here is it's not just a negotiation about getting a couple of dozen people who are held hostage home and the release of hundreds of more Palestinian prisoners. It's really setting the terms for what does the long-term vision look like there. And that's why it's been so difficult. It was difficult for the Biden team to get to the deal that was achieved right before they left office. And this is difficult in part because the end of the first phase of this ceasefire passed last weekend, and Israel was dragging its heels in part because it still has not wanted to really fully decide or clarify what it is driving for in terms of the end state in Gaza.
Just got about 15 seconds, but is Prime Minister Netanyahu effectively just stalling, and waiting to see what turns up?
Yes, and I fear that we may be slipping back into war here. All of these signals point to perhaps even more conflict between Israel and Hamas, and that would be devastating.
Brian Katulis is a senior fellow with the Middle East Institute. Thanks for your insights. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
Texas Democrat Al Green is the 28th lawmaker ever to be censured by the House.
On this vote, the yeas are 224, the nays are 198.
Some of Green's fellow Democrats voted alongside Republicans yesterday to rebuke Green. He says, though, he has no regrets. Here's NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt.
It all started during President Trump's address earlier this week to a joint session of Congress. Congressman Al Green stood up, waved his walking stick, and shouted at the president that he doesn't have a mandate. He was warned by the Speaker of the House to stop.
Take your seat.
But Green didn't stop.
The chair now directs the sergeant-at-arms to restore order. Remove this gentleman from the chamber.
Republicans readied a censure resolution, a formal rebuke for violating the chamber's code of conduct. Washington Republican Dan Newhouse introduced the resolution, saying it's a matter of decorum.
We must, as members of this institution, make sure our emotions do not take over and conduct ourselves in a way that all of us, not just here in this room, but across the country, can be proud.
But Massachusetts Democrat Jim McGovern said they didn't have those objections when it was Republican members interrupting a Democratic president.
I appreciate your selective outrage, but you'd have more credibility had you expressed outrage when your colleagues were heckling Joe Biden.
Green himself said he was speaking up for his constituents and would do it again.
There comes a time when you cannot allow the president's incivility to take advantage of our civility.
When it came time to vote, 10 of Green's fellow Democrats sided with Republicans. But many others in his party gathered around Green in the well of the chamber, singing, "We shall overcome." A sign Democrats remain split in how to push back against the Trump administration as the opposition party. Some argue bold moves like Green's are a sign of strength and show constituents they're doing something. But others say they put the spotlight on themselves rather than the policies they're trying to fight against. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, The Capitol.
This is NPR News.
Come on, boys!
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with David Johansen. He died last week. He was a founding member of the New York Dolls, a legendary 1970s band that never sold many records, but paved the way for punk rock. He also performed in his persona, Buster Poindexter, a pompadour-wearing lounge lizard. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation, collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Mildred Burke was one of the very first professional women wrestlers when she first stepped in the ring in the 1930s. She was the National Wrestling Alliance's Women's World Champion for nearly 20 years. A new film titled Queen of the Ring explores the rise of women's wrestling and also how someone like Burke could be so powerful in the ring and yet in many ways powerless outside of it. Emily Bett Rickards played Felicity Smoke in the CW TV series Arrow. She spoke with me about how she prepared to play Mildred Burke in the film, and a warning that a film clip played during our interview includes a scene of domestic violence.
Mildred Burke was a dreamer, a trailblazer, a warrior, and an all-time wrestling single mother who defied the era that she was in.
So kind of a badass, right?
I would say badass. Yeah, we could just go with that.
Yeah, in the 1930s, too, which kind of makes it a little more unique.
I mean, yeah, everything in her era was telling her that she wasn't allowed to have a dream of what she wanted to do or to do what she was doing. And, you know, she was one of those people that said, well, that's not fair, that's not right, and I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway.
And was it just because at the time women's wrestling wasn't considered feminine or acceptable? I mean, it was illegal in parts of the United States.
Yeah, and I think it's about, you know, women were powerful in their bodies. They were showing that you could be feminine and strong and looked, I don't know, I guess scary to men.
In Mildred's personal life, I mean, we're talking about like the men that try to control her, but the main one that really tries to control her is her husband and her ex-husband, Billy Wolf. And Billy Wolf is played by Josh Lucas in this film. He also abused her, hit her, wouldn't pay her equally at first. Here's one scene that kind of paves the way for their breakup later on. Let's hear that.
I ain't your damn caddy.
Yeah, well, you're still a woman.
It must just eat you alive that you never made a big time on your own, so now you live off a woman drawing more money than your sorry ass could ever dream.
I think when they first met, they were really in love. She finally had someone that believed in her dream. And then I think what happened is that when Mildred's sort of stardom was picking up, Billy felt as if he was falling into the shadows and taking out on her on an evil, horrible way. And at the same time, he really was a forward thinker in this area of wrestling. I mean, putting women on stage and having them wrestle was unheard of, and Billy was sort of the genius behind that, you know? And so it's this like really intoxicating, tumultuous, manipulative relationship of you're helping me achieve my dreams and you're a horrible partner.
You know, I think a lot of people think, well, how does a woman like that, that strong, still deal and struggle with domestic violence?
I don't think there's a perfect explanation out there for any of the things that we endure. You get used to a certain behavior and your bar will get lower. You'll keep telling yourself that you'll accept this thing. And Mildred was like, nah, I can't do that. She needed to compartmentalize the violence on one side and her dream on the other.
Now, there's a scene where Mildred is signing
papers with Billy. They become officially partners in the wrestling venture that they both have together. And then Billy's son comes up to Mildred and asks her this question.
Why did you marry him?
How often do you trust your daddy?
Not even half the week.
This paperwork is the only way I can protect us from him pulling tricks. You understand now, don't you, darling?
You're the headliner, but he still writes the headlines.
That's right.
Is that an equal partnership, do you think?
That is what Mildred considered equal at the time. She needed Billy. Because she wouldn't have gotten as far, at least from her perspective, without him. And unfortunately, it wasn't a smart business decision because Billy was always two steps ahead. And unfortunately, that didn't make for a pretty ending.
Yeah. So beyond just the general movie audience, how are you hoping that this piece maybe resonates with the hardcore wrestling fan?
You know, I've played in comic book world for a while, and I always thought the comic book fans.
By the way, Felicity Smoke in Arrow and also in The Flash, too. So one of my favorite shows. But go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Felicity's so dear to my heart. You know, comic book fans are also very protective of their love. You know, from the wrestling world and friends and fans and wrestlers themselves that have been a part of this film, we've gotten really great feedback. And so I'm really excited to see what the global wrestling scale thinks about it, because I do think that this is a story that hasn't been told. I didn't know who Mildred Burke was.
And you mentioned all the professional wrestlers that were cast in this film. Did you do your stunts, all your stunts?
I didn't do all my stunts. A friend of mine, Kelly Phelan, was my stunt double on this, and she's incredible. She took a lot of the bumps, but I did a lot of the wrestling, and I was definitely in the ring a lot. She takes some pretty epic falls, and she is rad.
What drew you to this role? I mean, because I mean, especially if maybe you're not a big wrestling fan, I mean, what made you want to say, hey, I want to be Mildred for this amount of time?
For me, it didn't really have a whole lot to do with the wrestling. I read her story, and it had so much heart in it. I mean, she really had this aspiration, this dream, and she did it all in style, being a single mother. And she thought that being, you know, a woman was a part of being strong. So much of that spoke to me. And the wrestling is sort of the vessel that it comes in, which is so cool. So yeah, I love diving into a new world. You know, that's diving into a new world and a new person is why I became an actor. It is such a privilege to be able to walk around and feel safe. It is such a privilege to have the right to choose, and it should be a free right. And Mildred really felt that the pendulum was so heavy on one side, and she was just ready to put her foot down or, you know, slam herself into the ropes to get it to swing back the other way. And she really blessed me with this role, because I learned so much that I'll take for the rest of my life.
That's Emily Bett Rickards. She plays the lead role in the biopic Queen of the Ring. It's out in theaters now. Emily, thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is NPR News.
It's been 60 years since law enforcement attacked voting rights marchers on a bridge in Selma, Alabama. That bloody Sunday helped spark the 1965 Voting Rights Act. But civil rights activists say the work is never over.
This progress is fragile, and every generation has to fight for it or we lose it.
I'm Ari Shapiro. That story from Selma on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Labor Department is reporting modest job growth in the U.S. during the month of February. NPR's Scott Horsley says the nation's jobless rate rose slightly to 4.1%.
U.S. employers added 151,000 jobs in February, a modest increase from the previous month. Construction companies added 19,000 jobs, a rebound after cold, snowy weather in January put a temporary freeze on a lot of outdoor work. The healthcare and manufacturing industries also added jobs last month. Restaurants and bars cut more than 27,000 jobs, and the federal government made job cuts as well. The report's based on a survey conducted in mid-February, so it reflects only a fraction of the government job cuts led by Elon Musk and his Doge team. The unemployment rate rose last month, even as some 385,000 people dropped out of the workforce. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, says the U.S. and Ukraine will be holding talks in Saudi Arabia next week on ending Russia's war in Ukraine. Witkoff says the U.S. and Kyiv are working on the framework for a ceasefire. Ukraine's president says he will travel to the kingdom on Monday. President Trump tells Fox Business News he sent a letter to Tehran asking if Iran would be open to negotiating a deal to curb its nuclear program. This is NPR News. SpaceX says yesterday's test flight of its giant Starship rocket ended in an explosion minutes after launch from Texas. As NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports, flaming debris from the crewless 403-foot rocket rained down on the Caribbean Sea.
The flight test appeared to start smoothly. The rocket took off from its pad in Texas and flew out over the Gulf. Starship separated from its massive Super Heavy booster. The booster flew back to the launch pad where it was caught by a pair of giant mechanical arms.
Stuck the landing.
Wow. That will never get old.
But moments later, several of the Starship's engines abruptly cut out as it entered space.
It looks like we are losing attitude control of the ship.
Starship then tumbled out of control before exploding over the Caribbean. This was the second failure in as many launches. Elon Musk hopes the rocket will one day carry people to Mars. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Authorities in Oregon say a vehicle discovered in the Columbia River by a diver several months ago may have belonged to a family of five who disappeared in 1958. Salvage efforts were called off before dark yesterday. They're expected to resume today. That vehicle is said to be in about 50 feet underwater, covered in mud and other debris. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 124 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Employers added 151,000 jobs in February. That's according to today's jobs report from the Labor Department. And 151,000 is a fairly healthy number, although it does not reflect the economic turmoil of the past several weeks. This is a snapshot of the economy, useful but ever so slightly out of date. NPR's Scott Horsley is here. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Steve.
So what is in and what is out of this snapshot?
Well, the monthly jobs report is always based on a survey that's taken around the middle of the month. And that timing is important here because a lot of the federal government job cuts began around the 14th of February, a Friday, which some people referred to as the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Yeah.
People who got their walking papers that Friday are still counted as employed in this February jobs report. The overall report actually shows somewhat more job growth in February than the month before, when cold, snowy weather was blanketing much of the country and keeping a lot of construction workers idle, for example. But even though the report looks pretty good on the surface, there are some warning signs out
there. Okay, when you look below the surface, what are the warning signs that you see?
Yeah, the outplacement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas keeps a running tally of layoff notices, and its count for February shows the biggest job cuts since 2020, which is, you know, the early months of the pandemic. Andrew Challenger says there were 172,000 layoffs announced last month, and that includes more than 62,000 in the federal government.
This is a really big number in terms of what we've ever recorded. The fact that we've reached that level so quickly this year is surprising to us and certainly something worth taking note of.
Now, the official jobs report today shows just 10,000 federal jobs cut last month, which we know is a fraction of the real total. We also know the Trump administration is considering much more widespread layoffs as it seeks to radically downsize the federal workforce.
Yeah, and it's numbers that couldn't affect the employment numbers in a measurable way. So what would that radical downsizing look like?
The administration reportedly wants to cut tens of thousands of jobs, for example, from both the VA and the IRS. The IRS already cut more than 6,000 workers last month. Eddie Walker represents some of those workers at an IRS office in Austin, Texas.
Of course, there's a lot of crying. I'm looking at some of the emails and stuff I've got, like they are ripping apart my work family. I left a job of 13 years to come here, and what do I get? How am I going to survive? I'm a single mom.
This is obviously painful for the affected workers. Some context important, though. There are about 2.4 million federal workers, not counting the military and the post office. That's about 1.5% of the overall U.S. workforce.
Oh, thanks for the reminder. The vast majority of people are working to state and local government or whatever, or in the private sector, of course. So how is the private sector holding up?
Yeah, restaurants and bars cut about 27,000 jobs last month. Temporary services cut jobs as well. There's been a lot of whiplash around the president's trade policy. I mean, just this week we saw tariffs imposed, then relaxed, then mostly suspended on Mexico and Canada. Andrew Challenger says a lot of private sector businesses are considering their own job cuts.
There's just been this extra uncertainty that's entered into some industries around tariffs, around potential trade wars. We're seeing big announcements from very large Fortune 500 companies this month that are tuning down their growth forecasts for the next 3 or 4 years.
So it's just not an environment that encourages a lot of hiring.
NPR's Scott Horsley, thanks.
You're welcome.
Thousands of refugees across the U.S. are wondering what will happen to them. That's because the Trump administration froze the program that resettles them. The move is being challenged by multiple lawsuits, but while those court battles unfold, aid groups are trying to figure out how to help refugees who have just arrived. Here's NPR's Jennifer Ludden.
When 21-year-old Jefferson landed in the U.S. in December, a case manager met him at the airport and took him right to an apartment.
Hello.
He and another refugee share this sparsely furnished one bedroom in Maryland. The case manager also helped him get a job operating a machine that packs lettuce. Jefferson is a political refugee from Nicaragua. He does not want to use his last name for fear of retribution against family still there. He's grateful to have been allowed into the U.S., but it was a shock in late January when his case manager disappeared.
Porque sentí que no tenía un...
I was left alone, he says, with no one to provide guidance in this new country where he barely speaks English. The case manager had been let go, their work phone shut down after the Trump administration froze funding and issued a stop work order for refugee resettlement.
Necesité ayuda en varios aspectos de mi vida.
Jefferson says he urgently needed care for a toothache and had no idea how to find a dentist. But his biggest fear was how to pay the rent. Typically, the federal government helps cover housing the first 3 months after someone arrives. His roommate panicked, then decided he had to pay for both of them. Remy Fael Abraham says it was tough.
Pues complicado porque pues prácticamente quedé en ceros.
Basically, I was left with no money, he says. I barely had enough to pay the bus fare to my job. This sudden abandonment has re-traumatized people, says Amy Huang Rona with the nonprofit Homes Not Borders. She says some were placed in hotels and just left there.
Many, many, many have lived in refugee camps for months, if not years, with the promise of help. And then they come here and then sit in a hotel for 1 to 2 months with no communication.
Rona's group readies apartments for refugees, but it has stepped up fundraising to do more.
We are filling in the gaps.
That includes hiring some of those case managers who got laid off, like Federico Rostron, who's now helping Jefferson again.
It's hard for them to identify what do they need to do, where they need to go.
Rostron helps people get a social security card, sign up for health insurance, enroll their children in school.
Teach them how to do things on their own and get confident about it and not to be intimidated.
Pausing all resettlement is part of the Trump administration's crackdown on immigration. An executive order said absorbing too many refugees takes resources away from Americans and harms their security. For Kristen Peck, welcoming them is a tenet of U.S. democracy. She heads Lutheran Social Services of the National Capital Area. The resettlement agency has cut a third of its staff and is owed more than $2 million in federal money for work already done.
The further existence of our organization is at risk at this point because we are unable to pay all of our bills.
A Supreme Court ruling this week may get that federal money flowing again. But for now, Peck's group is tracking who has eviction notices and pleading for patience from landlords. And if funding does not come back?
I think people will be at risk for homelessness. They'll be at risk for food insecurity, for joblessness.
Jefferson, the refugee from Nicaragua, hopes his case manager can stay on the job. In a year, he'll have to apply for a green card. And he'd really like expert help with that. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Children's book celebrates a blind girl's joy identifying birds on a nature walk with her aunt. Next time, here and now.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning, me Martinez. The Downards won this year's Royal Shrove Tide 1-0. Haven't heard of it? Well, it's sort of like ancient soccer played every Shrove Tuesday and Ash Wednesday. An entire English town packs the streets, hundreds of people per team fighting over a pumpkin-sized ball. It can get pretty rough. There are a few rules. Places of worship and cemeteries are off limits. No murder either. Don't really want to think about why they had to write that one down. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments,
Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Some Florida citrus growers are depending on genetically modified trees. An insect has been spreading what's called greening disease, which has really cut citrus production. The modified trees could ward off the insect. Here's Jessica Mazaros with member station WUSF in Tampa.
On either side of a sandy dirt road, Valencia orange trees tower overhead, with flecks of orange and yellow peeking through leafy green branches. 32-year-old Morgan McKenna Porter has spent her whole life in citrus groves.
We're the flagship industry, and it was part of the Florida dream. It was the white picket fence of Florida to own a grove.
She's the operations manager at her family business, McKenna Brothers, in Lake Wales. They not only manage their own groves, but also caretake for others.
At its prime, and really up until about 2 or 3 years ago, we were harvesting and hauling over 2 million boxes, and now we get excited when we hit 500,000.
That decline is thanks to citrus greening disease. The Asian citrus psyllid, a tiny brown-winged insect, infects these trees with a bacteria that essentially strangles the root system.
This yellowing in the leaves, instead of seeing that nice, really vibrant, dark green, is typically a sign of greening.
While the leaves yellow, the fruit turns green. McKenna Porter says it's standard to assume that every tree has been infected. But scientists at the University of Florida have been workshopping solutions with growers over the years. At a lab in Lake Alfred, researcher Lucas Stilinski introduces me to the latest in greening science, a genetically modified citrus tree.
Looks like any normal citrus seedling that you might see growing up in a citrus nursery prior to planting.
Behind some zipped-up netting is an unassuming plant with lots of green leaves sprouting about 2 feet up from a black pot. But this is no ordinary seedling. This one is a killer. It's been genetically altered to create a protein that forms holes in the gut of a psyllid.
When we started seeing dead psyllids, those are the days you live for, because science is very slow. So when you have something that works, it's a reason to celebrate.
While the initial adult psyllids can feed on a citrus tree, none of its offspring are able to survive.
It serves essentially as a population sink.
His team's research has been peer-reviewed and successful in the lab, but the real test will come if the tree survive the next 3 years in citrus groves. And even if it works, it could take a decade or more to really lift up the citrus industry.
In the meantime, people are going out of business. And that's the heartbreaking part.
It takes so long because they all have to be grown from seeds. For now, growers like McKenna Porter continue to use things such as antimicrobial treatments to keep the trees they have alive.
We'll have additional Band-Aid type therapies to keep us essentially on life support until there is that tree that's available.
She hopes when that time comes, there will still be a viable citrus industry here to save. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Mazaros in Lake Wales, Florida.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Production resumed this week at a Georgia factory that makes a high-nutrition peanut paste for starving kids. Grant Blankenship of Georgia Public Broadcasting reports its future is tied to what happens at the U.S. Agency for International Development.
A huge American flag hangs from the roof behind Jeremy Robinson's post on the factory floor at Manna Nutrition in Fitzgerald, Georgia. He makes sure Manna's packs of peanut paste don't leak before they ship, that they aren't wasted.
We save lives over here, sir. And that's a fact. We have the numbers. We have the numbers. It's a fact.
Each box he touches is enough to feed a starving child three times a day for 6 weeks. HR manager Stephen Rainey says these are kids so hungry, they can't sense hunger anymore.
These babies, they don't even have the energy to cry at this point. So they're listless. They're just there.
Manna ships their life-saving paste made from peanuts grown right here in South Georgia around the globe. The USAID logo and slogan, "From the American People," printed on every box. But about a week ago,
we got an email from USAID.
That's Manna CEO Mark Moore.
The headline was cancellation of contracts.
So he started lobbying.
We started pushing, reaching out to our congressional members who are super helpful.
Austin Scott and Buddy Carter, both Republicans.
Sending messages as best we could through to the administration asking, is this a mistake?
Because he'd heard the Trump administration say life-saving programs would not be cut. Days passed, and then Sunday night, another email. The contracts were back with no real explanation why. The State Department did not respond to our request for clarification either. Moore is, of course, relieved. And he says being able to save kids from starving again, it's more than a moral victory.
When you get to the last mile, to the end of the last road, where the people are the most desperate, you don't find a packet that says a gift of the Russian people or a gift of the Chinese people. But you do find packets of food that say a gift of the American people.
He calls it an America First message. With USAID staffing still in flux, Moore's greatest worry now is who is left to carry this gift of the American people to starving kids. For NPR News, I'm Grant Blankenship in Fitzgerald, Georgia.
Jessica Dobson has been playing music since she was 5 years old. She's a songwriter and guitarist who's performed with major acts like The Shins and Beck. Now, at the age of 40, after several albums with her band Deep Sea Diver, she says one of her favorite experiences in the studio was making their latest, Billboard Heart.
My description of Billboard Heart is it feels like open road.
My baby's got a Billboard heart, says please don't revive.
Dobson says she and her bandmates just kind of let the road take them.
And so when we were recording in the studio, we didn't have a plan other than here's the chords, let's just like see what happens. We ended up all just jamming for probably like 7 minutes. I mean, we cut it down on the actual record, but everyone was so locked in, no overthinking, almost like an out-of-body experience where it was just such an amazing moment of just like deep trust in the people that you're playing with.
However, to give herself the space to be creative, Dobson says she had to put aside feelings of self-doubt.
Which wolf are you going to feed, like the critic or the one that's the dreamer? If you're telling yourself the narratives that kind of drag you down, then that becomes the more powerful narrative for a while. And so I just had to deal with that.
I never thought of it that way. A wolf to feed. Oh my God, a predator to feed.
Yeah, and it can be a good thing. I guess maybe you could assign the good one maybe a better name than both being just wolves.
I think for me, it'd be a squirrel to feed. That's the way I feel
that's
sometimes. Yeah,
that's pretty nice and cute. I'll feed the squirrel today.
So I wanted to play this song, Tiny Threads. Let's hear a little bit of Tiny Threads. The theme of being tethered comes up a couple of times on the record. What are you trying to go for there?
Yeah, you're right. That is a theme. I think it has to do with the fragility of a moment of life, of the path we're walking through and how many different ways it can go. And wanting to make meaning out of even the things that feel extremely uncomfortable. And I think you know, hanging on by a thread doesn't have the greatest connotation, or it seems like, okay, well, she's barely hanging on there. But like, I think that there's such beauty to recognizing there is still a tiny thread that is holding me to, whether it's the people that I love or music. How am I making meaning in this moment? And the tiny thread is a thing of beauty, I think, ultimately, though.
Yeah, I saw a quote from you a while back where you said that you don't write Christian songs, but you definitely have written lyrics where they seem to be inspired by a Christian faith. How do we hear your faith in Billboard Heart?
You know, I grew up in the church, and my faith and my views have definitely morphed into a different realm since then. You know, I still believe in God, and the expanse of Mother Nature and being in tune with the things that I cannot see. And so I think there's like a mystic nature on this record that doesn't exist in prior ones. It makes no sense at all. All roads are winding into my soul, into my soul, into my... For me, faith is like trust. And so part of the faith that I carry is like, I have control over the decisions I make, but I do not have control over what happens. I think that there's such freedom in just letting go.
So it sounds like this album is allowing you to free yourself up for something.
I think now I needed to reclaim that childlike spirit that is so unprecious, so unbothered by anything in the future. It's just completely present. And if you don't have that when you're making a record, it's extremely difficult to find, I think, a soulful place. And I feel it on this record, and it feels really wonderful.
That's Jessica Dobson, the mastermind behind Deep Sea Diver. Her new album is called Billboard Heart. Jessica, thanks.
Thank you so much, A, for having me. It was a wonderful conversation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm A. Martinez.
That was a wonderful conversation, eh? Well done.
Thanks.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And now the Bill Evans Trio at the top.
We have for this night, very fortunately, Chuck Israels on bass.